When I was a student, as my daughter would say, when the dinosaurs were roaming the earth many years ago, there wasn't so much knowledge. It was easier to get up to the frontier of what we know in economics 30, 40 years ago, because there were just much less things to read, a lot less papers to read. But as the body of scientific knowledge has increased, it takes longer and longer to get to the frontier, to push that frontier forward.
Welcome to the newest episode of The Trajan Discourse, brought to you by the Economist Society at University College London.
We are delighted to be hosting Professor Van Reneen today, who is the Ronald Coase School Professor at the London School of Economics and Digital Fellow for the Initiative for Digital Economy at the Massachusetts Institute for Technology.
Professor Van Reneen's research interests include the cases and consequences of innovation, and much of his work focuses on the themes of labor market, research productivity, and public policy for dynamic growth.
He was the 2009 winner of the Yrjö Janson Award, the European equivalent of the John Clark Medal, the 2011 Arrow Prize, the European Investment Bank Prize of 2014, and the HBR McKinsey Award of 2018. Moreover, he was awarded the OBE for Services to Public Policy and Economics by the Queen.
Let's now proceed to the interview.
Welcome, Professor Van Reneen. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So we would like to start off by asking a couple of questions about your career.
Sure.
So your work predominantly focuses on understanding the causes and consequences of innovation. What influenced you to pursue your research in the field of economics of innovation?
I think it was just because I've always been interested in technology and ideas and how they've influenced the way the economy has changed and the way that people experience them in terms of how, where they're working and their jobs and their wages. And when I first started getting interested in economics, it came pretty clear to me if you wanted to understand why countries grew faster than others, or why some countries are richer or poorer than others, a lot of that had to do with technology and innovation. And that seemed to me the kind of fundamental driving force, really. Why is it the case in the last, since the Industrial Revolution, people have been lifted out of poverty, first in Western Europe, but later in America and in Asia. And really, that's a lot to do with innovation, new products, new processes, new ideas. So that seems to be the fundamental thing to kind of understand if you want to understand why countries are rich and some countries are poor.
Now on to your research. So first, maybe have some questions on your thoughts on the future of ideas and innovations. So in your paper, are ideas getting harder to find? You discussed the concept of diminishing marginal returns to research and increasing cost to ideas to explain why the Innovation Bank for R&D had declined. Could you briefly explain this concept to our listeners in the context of one of the case studies you reviewed?
So in that paper, we're trying to understand in some level why growth may have slowed down in recent decades. And what we find is that whether you look at the level of the economy as a whole or particular firms or particular technologies like semiconductors or crops or medicine, it seems to be the case that the amount of productivity you get from every euro or dollar you spend on research or scientists you employ doesn't appear to give you so much output as it used to in earlier decades. So, for example, if you look at more semiconductors, so we know in semiconductors, which is the root of digital technologies, we have this thing called Moore's Law, where you can, every 2 years or so, you can double the amount of transistors you can fit on an inch of silicon. And that's been happening since Gordon Moore predicted this in the late 1960s, the CEO of Intel. So that seems like an example of fantastic technological progress. If you something like 35% increase of productivity every year. But if you look at what's happened to create that, the industry has had to have more and more scientists and engineers working in research and development. So that's gone up since the 1970s by a factor of something like 17 times, if you like, more engineers and scientists, more effort gone in just to maintain that same level of productivity. So that's the sense in which you get less bang for your R&D buck or your scientific buck. And that, even in that area, which we think is one of the most dynamic areas, you've had to devote more and more resources to get that increase of productivity. And, at the macroeconomic level, you can see that because the fraction of people working as researchers and engineers or the fraction of GDP spent on R&D has gone up and up, yet the growth rate of productivity has not gone up. If anything, it's slowed down. And if you look at, whether it's medical research and cancer, or whether it's yield of crop you get from corn or from soybeans, you see the same kind of story. The ideas are becoming harder to find. And there's good reasons for that, of course. As you know, as students, when I was a student, as my daughter would say, when the dinosaurs were roaming the earth many years ago, there wasn't so much knowledge. It was easier to get up to the frontier of what we know in economics 30, 40 years ago, because there were just much less things to read, a lot less papers to read. But as the body of scientific knowledge has increased, it takes longer and longer to get to the frontier, to push that frontier forward. And so it either takes you longer as a student, you're going to be clever, of course, you're all smarter, but you're still going to work more and more years. So it's not just an undergraduate, you've got a master's, a PhD, et cetera, or you're going to work in bigger and bigger teams. So you see, if you look at papers, there's more and more authors on each paper. And that's because in order to make a push forward for new ideas, you need more and more people who know more and more about different specialist areas. But that becomes harder because you're coordinating, 10 people instead of just 2 people. So that also makes it harder to come up with new ideas. So, there's pretty good reasons why you see diminishing returns in ideas, as there is in most things in economic life, unfortunately.
Okay, so building on that, given the problem of declining research productivity and your recent policy proposal called the Hamilton Project, what are the most evidence-backed ways for governments to ensure sustainable dynamic growth?
Well, I think there's lots of ways. As you mentioned in this Hamilton Project report we did, we try to look at the evidence. So I always think it's important to look at the evidence. And we can cover lots of theories, but really, when you're trying to think about policies, you want to know what works and what doesn't work. That's where you should start. So we try to look at the best economic evidence where people had really made a big effort to try and look at the causal impact of policies. So, not just asking people, when you gave them some money for research, do you spend the money? But actually trying to say, look at a treatment group of some firms who say got a tax break or a subsidy compared to a control group of firms who didn't, and see whether or not that the subsidy for, say, innovation or research work. So we found that you could think about two groups of policies. So one group of policies is called demand side policies, because it increases the demand for firms to do innovation. So tax policies, for example, like research development tax credit, which incentivizes firms to do more R&D, or direct grants or subsidies like you might see in medicine or defense. Those do seem to be effective. So in terms of getting quick results, having good tax, good subsidy policies are effective in terms of getting more research and ultimately more innovation. But they have a problem, which is that if all you do is increase the demand for researchers in order to get more innovations, what you can often do if there's not a lot of researchers out there is just drive up the cost of doing R&D. So the wages of scientists like myself, we're very happy because our wages go up, but we don't necessarily do a lot more effort. you know, because there's only so many scientists to go around. So I actually think the best form of long-term policies towards innovation is to work on the supply side to try and create the kind of inventors and the entrepreneurs and the scientists of the future. So that's why, you know, human capital is very important, why, you know, encouraging people to, for example, study science and technology, engineering, maths, to increase the supply of people that way, you know, through universities and through decent grants is good. You should also have an open immigration policy to try and get as many, you know, you don't even have to pay, you know, you have to pay to create the scientists or engineers, you just import them somewhere else. Now, of course, you've got to be careful. You know, you've got to take too many away from developing countries who need them. But if people want to, you know, come and work in, say, in the UK and on a particular area, then you should be encouraging immigration, not discouraging it. And the third way is to think about what we sometimes call the kind of lost Einstein or lost Marie Curie effect. And that's my belief that we waste a lot of our talent in America or in Britain or almost any country in the world, because there's so many people who could be great inventors, Einsteins or Marie Curies, who don't end up being inventors, not because they haven't got the ability or the talent, but rather because they happen to be, you know, born, they might be born in a poor family where there's bad schools and bad neighborhoods, so they never even dream that they could be, you know, an inventor. Or maybe, you know, there's discrimination against women or against minorities, which puts barriers to them to be getting the education and getting the opportunity to become the inventors of the future. So I think that, you know, if we could do things to reduce some of those type of barriers, expose more people, especially from these disadvantaged groups, to the opportunities and ideas of becoming an inventor of the future, then I think we can unlock a lot of talent. So you can increase the quality and quantity of inventors. No, this is a very long-term project and got to work in schools and all to kind of do this. But I think in the long run, this would be one of probably the most effective innovation policy I could think of.
Your paper, The Fall of the Labour Share and Rise of Superstar Firms, showed how the winner-takes-most economy, where firms with a low labour share captured a rising fraction of industry sales, contributed to the fall of the US labor share. In the context of the pandemic, do you believe we are seeing strong enough shifts in consumer demand preferences, for example, towards digital entertainment, a relatively automated sector owned by a few conglomerates, and away from leisure activities such as tourism with relatively high competition and labor-intensive sectors, to cause a further fall of labor share?
Okay, so let me unpack your, if you didn't mind, I'll unpack the question a little bit. So you know, what the paper just is about, I mean, you, just to explain to people who might be listening in a bit more detail. So, you know, if you think about the size of the economy, national income like a pie, the pie can get divided into different groups. I think there's a part of the pie who goes to workers in terms of wages and salaries and employment. And there's a part of the pie which goes to capitalists, which is capital income and labor income. And it used to be thought, this is one of the so-called Kaldor facts after the famous British economist Nicholas Kaldor, that the share of the pie, the share of going to labor was kind of basically the same, didn't really change much. But what's happened, as you mentioned, Yashvi, is that in the US and many other countries since at least the early 1980s, and particularly since 2000, that share has gone down a lot. So economists are trying to think, well, what's happened? Why is the Kaldor fact no longer true? And one of the reasons we argue in the paper that you mentioned is that the economy has become increasingly dominated by these very large, what we call superstar firms, like Google, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, you know, as well in like in retail by, you know, Walmart, Costco, Tesco's and so on. And if you think about a company like Facebook, for example, one of the things you notice is that it's a huge company. But if you look at its sales revenue, only a very small fraction actually goes towards its workers. Workers get well paid, but compared to its profits and its sales, they only get a very small share of the overall Facebook pie, if you like. And of course, as more and more of the economy shifts towards companies like Facebook, or like Google, then that puts downward pressure on the overall share of labor. Not because the share of labor is going down in every firm necessarily, but because more and more of the economy is going towards these superstar firms, it's kind of, and if the economy is more winner take all, they win more and more of the economy. So that's the kind of background to that. Now, and your question was, well, you know, what's happened during the pandemic, and you know, is that going to increase that process? And I think it has increased that process, because one of the things which happened during the pandemic, as we all know, like we're doing now, is that more and more of our activities moved online. So, you know, you as students had to have more teaching online from professors. People who, instead of going physically to have meetings, could do meetings over Zoom, even if they're in different parts of the world. People started shopping more and more online, you know, rather than going out to the store and buying it from there. Now, those changes were already happening, but the pandemic kind of supercharged those changes. And you can see that if you look at the kind of the market value or the sales of these superstar firms. So they, you know, I think it was in January this year, Apple's market value exceeded $3 trillion. And that's bigger than the size of the British economy. So yeah, that's one example. And, you know, you can see that because of this greater move to digitization, there's more and more of those kind of online. Now, some of that may change as the pandemic recedes, but I actually think that it's likely to persist. I think once people have got used to, you know, doing more of these things online, and companies have realized they can save a lot of money by having more people working from home instead of going in the office, that many of these things are here to stay. So I do think that, you know, the pandemic has kind of meant that this phenomena of the growth of the superstar firms has become stronger, and that by itself will put downward pressure on the labor share. There's other forces though as well. So, you know, with, you know, a lot of job, you know, the economy coming back and more people demanding higher wages, that may go in the other direction. But I think the general trends are going to continue and become stronger.
Okay, thank you. Your work showed that tax breaks for research and development are effective innovation policies. However, you also found that labor regulation discourages innovation. Given this, how do you think governments should navigate this delicate balance between innovation and intervention?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think there's two things to bear in mind, I think, if you're thinking about good government policy. So one is that, you know, you want to have policies which are good for productivity growth, in the sense that, you know, to create a bigger pie, if you like, you know, you want to keep the pie growing at a regular rate. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to, you know, productivity growth gives you, and innovation gives you choices. You know, you don't need to, if you can become more productive, it doesn't mean that you need to spend it all on consumption and, you know, spending it more on buying expensive things. You could actually use it to take more leisure, you know, work fewer days in the week or weeks in the year. Or you could use that to improve, you know, spend more money improving the environment and cleaning up some of the environmental messes that we have to live with. So, you know, productivity growth gives you options. And as we talked about before, the best way to get productivity growth is to have stronger innovation. So, you know, the problem with innovation is that there's lots of market failures. The private sector generally won't produce enough innovation by itself, because, you know, one company gets a good idea, another company steals that idea. So the first company doesn't want to invest, you know, as much in innovation as it should do. So the government has to intervene, and taxation and subsidies and, you know, human capital policy, all the ways to get that. So that's one thing. Probably the most important thing is dealing with market failures the government has. The second thing, though, is that you have to make sure the benefits get shared. So if the economic pie just keeps on growing, but it's only like 1% of the population who gets all the share of those fruits of growth, then that's not only kind of an unethical and immoral thing, but it's going to cause you massive social and political problems. And that's one of the things we've seen in many countries over the last 10 or 20 years with growth, populism, Brexit, Trump, and so on. So you have to think of ways of sharing out the benefits of that increased productivity in a kind of equitable way. And, you know, regulation has to be part of that package. You have to think about how you make sure some groups don't suffer too much because of the changes. So in recent times, the growth of the gig economy has meant that, you know, we need to regulate that part of the economy more effectively, because people in the gig economy are doing very, very badly. But we have to realize there's a cost to doing that. Nothing, unfortunately, comes free. And, you know, if you do too much regulation, or you do regulation in a foolish way, you can end up damaging growth, which will also be a negative thing for ordinary workers, because if growth goes down, the pay on average will also go down. So you have to think about smart regulation, regulations which give protection, but also don't reduce innovation too much. So, for example, in France, where, you know, we studied the effects of regulation, there are huge amounts of additional regulation which come in when a firm gets to be 50 employees. So that acts as a very big disincentive for firms to grow, and that's why it can chill innovation. So I think that you could think about relaxing some of those regulations in France, and in some ways bringing in some of the people who are not regulated very well, like people who are working in the gig economy, which would make it somehow more equitable playing field for people in different parts of the economy, but different parts of the labour market.
If you could time travel 50 years in the future, how do you think our discipline would have changed? How innovative do you think the world would be then?
You mean how different would economics be?
Yes, economics as a discipline.
How would economics be different? You know, there was this, I think it was Karl Marx was once asked, tell me what socialism would look like. And he responded saying, well, I can't tell you what communism, I can't tell you what communism will look like, because it's the music of the future. And if I could write the music of the future, I'd have already written it. Now, you know, in historical retrospect, given what happened, it's a bit of a mistake of Marx not to have, you know, put more thought into what might have happened, you know, had the communist revolution actually happened as it did. But there was a grain of truth in what he said. It's very hard to predict the future of ideas, because if you could predict them, you'd be doing them. I'd be writing the paper. But I think there'll be, I'd say three things would be different. So I think that, and we're already seeing this now, economics will be even more empirical than it currently is. So there's been a big turn in economics over the last 10 or 20 years, a very healthy one, towards looking more at data and doing more empirical work rather than writing, you know, grand. When I was doing my grand theories, when I was writing my PhD, all the prizes, Nobel Prize, were given to grand theorists who are doing amazing theories. Now the Nobel Prize are actually given to people who are actually much more empirical, trying to figure out what policies work, like we were talking about before, or, you know, what's actually happened to labor markets and product markets. So I think there'll be even more empirical, be a bigger emphasis on data. And I think my second point is, partly because of that, there'll be, as we're seeing now, a lot more close integration between economics and data science and computer science. So the boundaries between what we do as economists and what people do in computational statistics and data analysis will be much more closely aligned together. So all the work we're seeing in artificial intelligence and machine learning, economics will start looking more like that. In fact, there may even not be a distinct discipline of economics. It might be part of a more broader social and behavioral science, where we take data more seriously than we currently do. And I think that the third thing would be, I think that there'll be a way, a kind of internationalization of economics in a much greater sense than it currently is done. At the moment, it's still very much dominated by the United States and to some extent by parts of Europe. I think that the center of gravity is shifting much more towards Asia, China and India. I think many of the kind of economic problems that those countries face, you know, with very big populations, still maybe partly in the kind of development phase, although that could completely have changed in 50 years' time. But I think there'll be a much more eclectic set of issues which are done, rather than the ones which necessarily are the ones that we focus at the moment, which are more based on kind of US kind of. And I guess part of that is, like, you know, in the US, markets are generally much more flexible, whereas in most other countries, institutions play a much bigger role. I think that will be part of the way that economics changes. We'll take institutions and policies much more seriously as things to study and understand, rather than just saying, you know, they're just frictions and problems that we have to do when we think about markets. So I think those are three ways. I think it'll be more data oriented. It'll be a closer interdisciplinary angle, especially with computer science. I think the subjects will kind of shift geographically towards issues which are less important and for America are more important for countries like India and China.
That's all the questions we have for you. We have finished this episode with you, and thank you.